Welcome to the Nordic Mythology Podcast. I'm Daniel Farrand, owner of the company Horns of Odin. And today I'm joined by Katie Beard. Katie, nice to meet you. And I also have to say, how many times do you get the comparison of your surname with studying Viking Age stuff? It must happen all the time, surely.
More often than you'd think. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Or it's Katie Beard doesn't have a beard, that sort of thing. Yeah,
mm-hmm. So I've been thinking all day of beard jokes that I could lace into the podcast at points, but I didn't really come up with many, to be honest. So you say,
yeah, it's okay. Yeah, I know, absolutely. It's not a terrible name.
No, it's not by any means. I think really you would expect me to have that name. Like, I feel like, if I had that name, I would just get comments all the time of like, oh, beard by name, beard by nature, or something like that.
No, absolutely. Or if you ever shaved, it would be, why don't you have a beard?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I can't shave. If I shaved, you know, the little cherubs that you see on like the Trevi Fountain in Attila, that's exactly what I look like if I shave. I just look like a cute little boy.
That's always fun.
What an introduction. Do you want to just spend a second and let people know who you are and maybe what we're going to talk about?
Sure. So my name is Katie, and I am a DPhil or a PhD student. We call it something different in Oxford, at Oxford University in the United Kingdom. I'm reading at Lineker College. My current research considers these sorts of Old Norse symbols of power, and I try to explore their meanings in this mythological context from the mythological and the saga literature and their connection specifically to the archaeological record. So I look at lots of these sorts of objects of power, often miniaturized. So these, your Thor's hammers, spears, swords, thrones, heads, these cup-bearing figures. And the symbols I find are really an invaluable glimpse into sort of this daily life and lived experience of the people of the Viking Age. And then looking at that hundreds of years gap between the material and seeing what transmits into the literature, what's saved, what's not, how that's changed over time. And then why we know about these symbols today so much that oftentimes people, wear them themselves, even in modern times, what the reception of that is. So how they've kind of rose in status and maybe later faded away. My research typically has a data-driven approach. I run a Thor's hammer database connected to my MA out of the University of Iceland, which I did with Terry Gunnell on Thor's hammer amulets. So it's a database with an analytics platform on top of it called EtriDB, Etri database. And and that's available publicly online. And that database is hopefully going to be expanded with many other symbols of power, as I call them, in the future with the publication of my PhD research. So that's a very brief introduction of who I am and why I'm here.
Yeah, it's a good one. Okay. Is it mainly just, does everything have to have a basis in an archaeological standpoint? So do you have to have like a little physical figure or item for you to have studied? Because the one thing that always comes to mind, this is the first question that came to my head, and it's probably
sure
completely off topic and you won't be able to answer it. So what a great first question. The one symbol that we've all heard of, obviously, the Helm of Awe. And
sure,
as a new symbol, we all have seen it, and you see the arguments time and time again of how it's not traditionally, a Viking Age symbol. But obviously in Fafnir, there is something in the lair of Fafnir, which is called the Helm of Awe or the Helm of Terror. I'm not going to try and pronounce the Icelandic version. So I've always wondered so much about that. And if there is, and I don't know if that falls into your research, but as soon as you said like in the saga literature and symbols of power, that's the one that I just automatically went to because it is such a controversial symbol today.
Sure. So, of course, I understand. I know where you're coming from, right? So the Helm of Awe is from these sorts of, and a lot of these, Galdurstaver, right? These sorts of magical staves come from these sort of post-medieval manuscripts that we find in Iceland. Ultimately, a lot of there's a history of transmission and recording that happens over time, and there could be a connection, maybe there isn't, but something has been preserved over time that has been written down, right? Perhaps those are connected, perhaps they're not, honestly. Or maybe somebody had read that poem who was thinking about the post-medieval manuscript, mm-hmm. and might have connected that. It's one of those things that authorship and who has read what and how these sorts of things are connected, because Iceland, of course, is a very literate culture. They're going to be aware of these sorts of things even in the post-medieval period. Mm-hmm. So it could be a complicated relationship. So it might be something that has been preserved, maybe not in the form that's preserved in that manuscript, but it could be something you trace back. I, of course, haven't traced that myself. It would be interesting to trace it. That would be that I haven't necessarily connected those two passages before, but that it makes me wonder if there is maybe some sort of either faint line or bright line connecting. Maybe somebody had read something like that when they were composing the manuscript or transcribing it.
I'm sure somebody must have tried. Somebody must have.
I'm sure. Yeah, I'm sure. Have.
It's such a controversial symbol that surely somebody must have tried to figure out if there is a link.
Yeah, it's possibly.
It's one that's, it is one that's always fascinated me. And I think I heard a theory once about the item in the lair being a helmet of, is it the, who would be like the sea god? Is it Aya?
Mm-hmm.
So it'd be like Aya's helmet, and it'd like being an actual physical helmet. But again, these are things that you just see popping up on in those pesky Facebook groups of people claiming they know the answer. But I do like to read them and see different theories.
I don't think there's a definitive answer, honestly. These sorts of things change all the time, and they changed even in the written sources based on who was copying or transcribing, or, there's so many different oral traditions that probably existed before the literature was written down. It could have changed based on what fjord people were positioned in and who was telling what story behind, around what campfire or whatever else.
So. Yeah, absolutely. It depends on, like I say, it probably depends on the telling of where it was, what time period it was from.
Would make
a big difference. Maybe each area had their own special little item. I find it fascinating that it is the one thing that's kind of picked out as being in there. But it does fuel, I love it. It does fuel so many like online little arguments and disagreements. And I think as well, because so many people do get that symbol tattooed on them. Maybe when you first get into this kind of stuff, then you get that and the Vegvisia tattooed and then quickly realize they're not like traditional symbols. But you still have to kind of die on that hill, I think.
What is a traditional symbol in that respect though? Like what is, yeah.
Yeah, well, that's it. Yeah. That is it. I guess it would be anything that features on something from
the Viking Age.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah. I've always been, especially somebody who studies medieval Iceland, right? Those post-medieval manuscripts are so very neat in their own right. So I also have a Vigdísir tattoo, and honestly, those sorts of things, they have their own really cool manuscript history, and And I encourage anybody who's feeling that way to investigate that and find out how cool they are on their own as well. And it doesn't necessarily have to be connected directly to the Viking Age. Yeah.
I'm completely on board with that. I think people should get tattoos or whatever they want.
Absolutely.
If it makes them happy, but you do say get a lot of people who just, I don't know, people, I think this is one thing I found from doing this podcast for so long, probably because I was one of them when I first started. Obviously, I don't come from any scholarly background. I've just sat here and had these conversations now with 160 different people. So, you know, I've picked up some things over the years and I learned a bunch of stuff. But when I first started, I think that you do just kind of read the very base introduction websites, blogs, memes that pop up, and you get a bunch of information and you don't know any better. So you kind of just think everything is black and white almost, and it's very simple. Yeah. And we must have like some sort of Bible out there that's going to tell us all this stuff, and we know it to be true because you don't have time to research deeper. And then, so I think then you get into these arguments online, because I did when I was probably at that point, because you think you know everything. So you, like, if somebody gets something wrong, it's like you want to tell them to make sure, whether it's just to be right or it's to try and help. But then the more you learn, you kind of like, oh shit, we actually know all about all of this.
We know precious little about what old Nordic religions were. And I say religions on purpose, because I think that there is many, many different variations and things over time, space, and place. Mm-hmm. And we're looking at it through a really fragmented lens, right? We're looking at it hundreds of years, centuries after what was happening, through medieval scribes in basically in Iceland mostly. And we're trying to piece this sort of story together with what we have in the extant archaeological record. And that's tough. And it's really fascinating. But one of the things that I've learned from looking at old Nordic religions specifically is how little we actually do know for certain. And even if we did know things for certain, the variations would be so wildly different. Mm-hmm. That it's not something that we can put some sort of dogma on or some sort of structure as we sort of want to impose on it. Even a pantheon isn't necessarily something that is something that we can really ascribe to, honestly. Wow. I point to Terry Gunnell's article about Norse pantheons and what that means. So
yeah, he has a brilliant one for free on academia.edu. Talking about how Thor could have been the leader of the pantheon. He could have been the chief. And it's a fascinating article, so anybody can go and read that. It's brilliant. But I think you're absolutely right. And this is something I've spoken about a bunch on here, so we can move on. Because I'm sure everyone listening to this is like, I've heard this so many times before.
Sure.
It is such a fascinating.
It's worth repeating.
Yeah, absolutely. Because as well, I think that's part of the love. And I've said this tons of times. It's part of the love and charm for people who get into this, because it's so much easier to apply to your own life when there are so many gaps, so many variations. You can fit it neatly into your own worldview and how you are at a certain point in your life, and you can kind of adapt it to suit. It isn't rigid and structured. It's kind of the appeal for me anyway.
Yeah. No, I understand. Totally understand. It's very funny, because sometimes, people will be like, well, who's the Norse god of love? And I'm like, what does that even mean? You're like, okay,
because they want Cupid. They want
they
want the Nordic Cupid that they can tell their girlfriend or boyfriend that they love them. Like, you were stuck with the Nordic Cupid's spear, I guess.
Nobody wants to hear the academic go, well, actually,
that's the thing. It's when how much time do you have to sit down and listen to the actual answer?
Right. No, exactly.
Okay. So let's talk symbols of power.
Sure.
Sounds like a cool TV show.
Well, hopefully it'll be a good title of a PhD thesis here. So then,
yeah, for sure. Oh, you mean your PhD thesis cannot be that short? I thought the titles had to be like
it's pretty long. Yeah. It's not set in stone yet, but it'd be this symbols of power, the rise and fall of Viking Age symbols in Old Norse literature and archaeology. So a nice colon, but symbols of power.
Yeah. I see what you're doing there. I was going to say that can't be the title. It has to be longer.
No.
Okay. No. So is there a best starting point? Are we best start? Because I imagine the most we probably know about or the most popular one would be Milner.
Do you want
to start there or do you want to finish?
That's definitely, we can start there. That's so, I worked on, this for my master's thesis in the, done at the University of Iceland. And, that was kind of the starting point of this symbol research that I've kind of found myself, in. And, primarily coming from a literature perspective, when I was doing some of my exploratory research, I kept coming across this number that literature scholars would cite whenever they were talking about Thor, and it would be something like, in the 60s they counted 40 or to 50 silver Thor's hammer amulets that would be there. Now, looking very, very lightly, even just Googling and things, quickly realize that number is completely wrong, right? Yeah, okay. It's not 40. It's closer to 400, right? Yeah, it's and counting, because we have metal detectorists coming to light with new archaeological finds every day, mm-hmm. and it was and they were coming from all over the place and looking at, and they were in different shapes. They weren't necessarily this sort of classical V-shaped hammer that you traditionally associate with Thor's hammer sometimes. And looking at all that variation, I thought there's a real value in centralizing a lot of the different databases that are out there, getting some of these out of card catalogs, right? Mm-hmm. Trying to aggregate some of these new finds that metal detectors are often finding.
How many of those don't go reported as well? Guarantee there will be.
I find them on eBay. I find them on Etsy. I find them, antiquarian.
As in genuine. How would you tell?
So it's hard unless you buy them, right? But some of them, definitely you look at them and you go, oh no, somebody has gotten this out of their attic or whatever else and is selling them online, if any, on the black market or whatever else. Mm-hmm. And that's something that is both frustrating and also exciting to see how many of these things are. It's frustrating from an academic perspective, but also fascinating in that respect.
Out of curiosity, how much does a black market Viking Age Milner go for?
hopefully to buy and then give to him, donate to a museum. I found them as cheap as a couple hundred pounds.
Wow.
And especially out of places where the market is a little less regulated and things. And that's, it's heartbreaking and as well, but, and it's hard to verify, of course, with pictures. I get people emailing me pictures of things that they bought all the time saying, can you verify this for me? And I'm like, I can't.
That would be my concern. That's why I would never, I lie actually. This is reminding me of a memory. When I first got into all this, I bought a little bronze ring that said it was from the Viking Age, and I don't know if it is or not. I've no idea. Looks cool. I don't know actually. I don't know where it is. I've lost it, but I did buy it. It cost me like £40, so it probably wasn't. But it could have been.
You never know, honestly. It's It's hard also because as soon as you find these things on the internet, you often will lose any provenance of the object, right? Where it's where it came from, where they found it. It's genuine from the Viking age, 800 to 1000. And you're like, oh, okay, so somebody Googled what date ranges might be or whatever. Yeah. You get some things that are spurious, or like I found in York, and you're like, okay, where, what, you know, like
York. Yeah. Obviously has to be York as well, because right. You know, where else are you going to find something from the Viking age in England? If you're trying to convince people you found something from the Viking age in England.
Yeah. So these sorts of things, they get found often. So there's a lot of judgment calls about what goes into the database and what doesn't, and that sort of thing. But long story short, I found a lot, and I still have hundreds in queue to put into the database as it currently exists, where I'm, you know, cleaning up data and whatever else. And so it's counting, and you get these metal detectorist databases or Facebook groups and things where people are discovering new things all the time. And it's fascinating and exciting. Mm-hmm. And we're learning more and more about what's happening in real time in the Viking Age. One of the most exciting things about archaeology is how much gets found and how our perceptions of some of these the Norse gods are changing because of it. You know, I'm sure your audience knows about the Bracteate that just got found with.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about that next week.
Yeah. And that, you know, of course, that's going. I can't wait to see all the papers and conversation that's generated about that, because Odin may be way older than we thought, and that's really quite interesting, because we've talked a little bit about Thor being this larger god than is in sort of this popular mythology that we've got. And that maybe Odin might have been this sort of unifier that was a little later. Maybe not. So these sorts of things happen all the time. Mm-hmm. Coming back to the hammer on that same point, there's been discussion that the hammer wasn't a hammer at all. And that's been discourse for, it was primarily in that sort of 1980s, 90s, et cetera. It was an axe that was, you know, we don't necessarily, a hammer's kind of a weird weapon. You know, it's a smithing weapon. Yeah. Thor's not a smith, right? There's no attestation to him being a smith in the mythology that we know of. Mm-hmm. So there is a discussion that maybe not a hammer at all. Maybe it's an axe. Maybe it's this glorified axe. But in 2014, that might have been a lag on my part. In 2014, there was a hammer that got found that had a runic inscription on it, which you don't necessarily find on these things. And it said basically, you know, I am a hammer on it. And you go, well, you can't really argue with primary text like that. We don't get much of that in archaeology, right? So those sorts of conversations change all the time based on what comes out of the ground. Mm-hmm. And I cut you off. Sorry about that.
No. But I guess that doesn't prove whether Thor's hammer was a hammer, right? If it's just,
sure,
if it's just
these
if you
things,
just, if you just because you said you just have, did you say that? Oh, okay, so it was one of those that said it was a hammer on it. Oh, yep. Okay. I thought you said it was an actual hammer.
No, it was a.
I'm with you. Yeah. Okay.
Out of Denmark.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what I was going to say before was that I'd heard this idea that it was an axe before, but
yeah.
I also feel like a hammer is a really good fucking weapon. I know people are like, it's not typically a weapon. I'm like, I mean, war hammers are a thing. And
usually they have long handles though.
They do, but this one has a short handle because something went wrong.
And some of them do have long handles some of the amulets do. Mm-hmm.
So, I wonder when, I don't know when Warhammers came about in popularity. But it's just a, for me, it's just a it is quite a good weapon, depending on the situation. Like, not if somebody's wearing armor, but if I was a smithy and somebody attacked my house, I'm grabbing my hammer. If I don't have an axe, probably like an axe would probably, an axe would probably be the better one. But I still feel like people are like, oh, you know, hammer's not a weapon. It's not a feather. Like, it's still
some real damage with a hammer.
It's still a big lump of metal on the end of a stick. It's still gonna, you know, it's gonna hurt.
Yeah, it certainly would. Yeah, you don't necessarily want to get hit by a hammer. Mm-hmm. You know, and Thor bashes lots of Jotnar in the east with his hammer in mythology all the time, right? So that's how that goes.
Yeah, and I also wondered whether it was a hammer, because I assume smithies will have been seen as very high importance. You know, it's a skilled job, and everybody wants to have a nice sword or any metal item, whether it's a little nice thing to hold your pot above your fire, or a sword or an axe. You know, it's a skilled job that you require and you really need them. So they're going to be held in high esteem.
Oh, sure.
I imagine they would probably be quite muscular, well-built, and yeah, I just feel like it would be someone that you'd hold in high regard. And maybe the god would want to have something a little bit different than what everybody else has got. If everybody else is fighting with a sword and an axe, if you have a god, like, he needs something a little bit more special, I assume, anyway.
There's a certain magic and power associated with smithing, right, just in general, where the smith was doing some sort of alchemy, almost, where it's this sort of thing that happened apart from the community, and it was very specialized and whatever else. Maybe there's something there too, I don't know, but there's clearly this very in the literature, the hammer is like is a thing, and maybe it grows out of something else. When I compiled this database, and you look at you take data, you know, hammer data like this, and there's a lot of different varieties of hammers. Ones with long handles, ones with short handles, ones with little loops on the top, ones with just a hole, ones on multiple chains or big rings that you find made out of silver, made out of amber, with, you know, V-shaped heads, with round heads, with cross-shaped heads, all kind of lumped into this hammer. Hammer sort of symbol. If you break it down by type, right? So that's what I was trying to break it down, so we could look at analyze the data on various different axes. So like what I was saying is, where do all the silver hammers come from? You click in the database, silver, and it shows on the map.
Okay.
All the silver hammers come from this area. And what I did that was different than some of the other things that have been done is I did it by shape. Where do the round headed hammers come from? Where and when? And where and when did the V-shaped hammers come from? When did the cross shaped hammers come in?
When you say round head, do you mean as in, is it the Ukos, the Finnish looking one? Is
sort
that,
of,
that
yeah.
kind of we, shape?
Yes. So that sort of shape, but I don't go into the Baltic material in the database. It was too much, but there is some crossover there with that sort of shape. When it comes to looking at those sorts of things over time, space, and place, we kind of have this axe-like hammer being some of the earlier ones, and you get the sort of flat and sort of rounded head coming a little bit later. High Viking Age was the thing that you see mostly, the V-shaped, right? Then in popular amulets. And then you get the last sort of step, which was this sort of cross-like hammer, often suspended upside down, which you wouldn't with a crucifix, but almost looks like that sort of upside down cross, right? Mm-hmm. And so you wouldn't necessarily be able to track that over time very easily by just looking at, you know, disparate data points. So that's the value of putting these things in conversation with each other like that. Does that, if that makes any sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. I have a question.
Sure.
Okay, bear with me on this. So this just got me thinking. If the early ones looked like an axe and then the later ones more hammer, isn't it true or maybe I'm remembering this wrong, that Christian like monk type people can't spill blood, like they can go to war and fight, but maybe it's in the medieval period. I'm sure there was an archbishop called Odo, I might be remembering this wrong, sometime around like Thomas Becket time. And he used to carry like a mace or a club because like a bishop figure could fight, but couldn't use like a sharpened weapon. It would have to be like a club or
interesting.
A blunt object, because they weren't meant to technically spill blood. They could bludgeon you to death, but they can't. It was not meant to like spill blood in the way of like a slice. And I always remember that from school, from my great history teacher I shout out and hear a lot, called Mr. Ainley. And I just remember that. So then I was just thinking then, as you said, maybe it's gone in time period, maybe my time periods are all off, which I know Thomas Becket was hundred years later. But that idea of maybe as Christianization came, if maybe the axe turned into a hammer because maybe this godlike figure wasn't meant to spill blood in the way of like a slice with an axe, and it was more of a blunt tool. Oh, somebody put in the chat here, William the Bastard's brother. So it's not that long. So William the Conqueror's brother, Bishop Odo, fought with a club at the Battle of Hastings. So it's actually not too. I'm actually quite impressed with myself that I remembered this from high school. And I think that's what it was. It was to do with like this godly figure wasn't meant to carry like a sword or an axe. So we are kind of in the similar time period. So that's where my mind went as soon as you mentioned the axe being older and then the hammer type being later. I wondered if that could be.
You get molds and things with these hammers where there's a hammer on one side and a Christian cross on the other. Possibly there some enterprising smith was like, well, might as well make both, throw the whole, if you're going to appeal to one God, might as well appeal to another, you know, sort of thing. I do think there was a lot of contact between this and in the Viking Age here, and that I know that changed and influenced what symbols were used, right? You get rune and picture stones where you get, you get somebody like Vidar breaking Fenrisulfr's jaw, and then it could be also a Christian hellmouth, right? There's some really interesting interplay between this sort of pre-Christian religion and the coming of Christianity. And I think that's one of the things that changed this hammer cycle, was the contact between the sort of pre-Christian people and then trading and raiding in Christian contexts. Mm-hmm.
The ones you can maybe dispel this myth for me or not. The ones that look like little crosses, I used to hear that was for trade purposes, so they could like turn it upside down and then it looks like a Christian cross and be like, I'm a good Christian now, please trade with me. Because obviously being Christian opens up to a trade network.
Sure. Could do, maybe. I think it's more of an evolution in style than something like that. That's very, very clearly like having this sort of like cross-shaped hammer often has a suspension loop at that on the reverse end. That'd be very funny to me, but maybe it's a different time period, right? So it's difficult to get into the minds there, but I think it's a logical evolution of where the hammer shape was starting to go. So you start getting this V, and then it's just elevating itself up. Mm-hmm. That's where I sit, opinion wise.
Yeah, it seems to me more likely that it's like a transitional period type thing, as you're kind of blending. Because that's the other thing I think we have to remember, that the Christianization wasn't just like a snap of the fingers overnight thing. It was a gradual change. So people are kind of moving and edging, and it's like the slow.
Oh, yeah. Well, there was also cross traditions throughout the Viking Age as well, right? We get these sorts of crucifixes in Birka with, you know, the Christ-like figure looking really skeletal and funny on these sorts of, you know, square crosses. So I don't think it's a binary thing where it's like it was a hammer and then it was a cross. It's very much so this sort of mishmash, you know, cross-cultural, cross-religion sort of thing that was happening. Mm-hmm. And maybe people were also trying to appeal to multiple things, right? You know, you get graves where there's a Thor's hammer and a Christian cross in the same necklace or in the same pouch or whatever else. And you're like, well, why would that be? Maybe that wasn't necessarily the concept of religion back then. It's like, you might as well be appealing to whatever God might be. My neighbor says this Christ guy, he's pretty cool. Mm-hmm. Maybe I try that too. I think that there was a lot more cross-cultural pollination than we think.
So when I had Georgia Sotetetti on here, and we spoke about pocket idols, she told us that most Milners were found in female graves. Did you look at that in your research, and where they were found?
It's a complicated question, because a lot of grave finds that we find Thor's hammers in are sexed female. There are some very prominent graves where you find Thor's hammer amulets that are sexed male, Repton and things. I have a hard time with staking that as a really firm claim because of how many we've found now that are loose. Okay. We don't find them in context often, right? We don't find them in graves as often, but we find them loose all the time. So I definitely like, you find the majority of hammers found in graves are found in sexed female graves, not exclusively. There are ones that are sexed male. But there's so many that are just, you know, found in a field or found in wherever that, you know, could have fallen out of a pocket, that I have a hard time collectively making that claim. That's a terrible academic answer, isn't it? It's not very satisfying.
No, but
George is definitely right that like a lot of the hammers we do find in graves are in that sexed female grave. But there, you know, when you look at the ratio of where they're found, there's so many more that are coming to light that are just found loose. Mm-hmm. So
were people just really clumsy and didn't look after their things? Because why do you just find these? Cause I imagine, you know, again, metal was valuable at the time. These would have been valuable pieces. So why do we find them just loose, just like on its own?
It could be, you know, fallen out of something, a pocket or a pouch or off of a chain or whatever else. It could be just the attrition of time, right? Things get knocked loose. People build parking lots, till fields, whatever else, and we're turning up soil all the time. There could be quite a, I think that a lot of, you know, it's when we do find things that have context, that's so special and great. And that's one of the reasons why it's so important to make sure that we empower people who are metal detectorists with the tools to give us context. Because oftentimes you're just looking for something that's beeping and you're like, oh, look, this thing is cool. And then you leave everything else that's there. I don't know. So I think that there could be a lot of reasons, honestly, but you find loose stuff all the time, right?
No, it just makes me think of how many of these must there have been if we're just finding so many loose ones.
Yeah, it's a small. One of the things that is both exciting and frustrating about working with archaeology is I like to call it a Swiss cheese data set, right? We're looking at something that's fundamentally incomplete and will always be incomplete. Mm-hmm. And do you throw out the cheese because there's big holes in it? And you don't. You take what you have and you try to figure out what's there and what this might mean. Mm-hmm. And sometimes data and things can tell stories that you don't anticipate about other periods and about the current way we collect things. Like in Atri, the database that I have is Norway doesn't have as many Thor's hammer finds as say Denmark or Sweden or whatever else. And I think that probably has to do with metal detector laws.
Oh, really?
And yeah, it's because there's more material that's been found. It doesn't necessarily have to do so. Their data can tell a different story based off of what. So you can't necessarily trust numbers all the time either. Mm-hmm. You know, it's so tempting to be like, well, that's the data, but that's data tells its own story as well, and you have to interrogate that. Because there could be other influences, you know, geopolitical borders are weird, right? Like we didn't have borders as such, you know, what is something in Germany, modern day Germany could be, you know, something in a completely different space. So mm-hmm. we can't necessarily blindly trust data as well. If this makes sense.
So are Norway's metal detector laws tighter?
Yeah, I think so. Or reporting, you know, is harder. That's also a thing.
They're pesky. They don't report them. That's what it is.
Yeah, you have to. Well, like one of the things that's great here in the UK is we've got things like the portable antiquity scheme where people can report their loose finds. Pretty easily, and you get there's also some in initiatives in Denmark and things. The DIME, the database there where people can collect things. Finland, they're doing some interesting stuff with metal detector collection. I'm not particularly an expert in this, but there's a lot of really neat developments, and I tend to fall on the side of I think that the more stuff comes out of the ground is great as long as people are reporting it, and mm-hmm. And most people who are hobbyists like this want to be reporting things and want to add to the body of knowledge. And I think we should really trust people a little bit more about that.
I would have thought more people wouldn't report it. So maybe that's the skeptic in me.
And I think that most people who are in it, like hobbyist metal detectors, are really quite interested in history and are very excited about reporting things.
I think the cheaper, maybe the cheaper that metal detectors become, then I don't know. Maybe people are just going out looking for riches, just trying to find something. I guess it depends on your goal, but yeah, maybe, I don't know. And then I was thinking that the harder that times get, you know, people are in a little things are. A cost of living crisis, whatever you want to call it. And then people like find things, maybe think they're going to find something worth money. So it's like, well, why do I want to just give it over to the government?
Sure.
Maybe it's worth something. Maybe I can sell it. I don't know. I think if I had a metal detector and I found a cool little Thor's hammer, I would definitely have an internal discussion on whether I wanted to keep it or hand it over. And I'm someone who's obviously clearly very interested in this, spend a lot of my time talking about it. But I still would be like, this is very cool. I like this. I want to keep it. I don't want to give it over. I would love and cherish and respect it. But then also the part of me is like, I have to I would give it over in the end, because that would be the sensible thing to do. But I would definitely have like that discussion with myself of how I really would like to just keep it. So I can understand maybe why people do.
Yeah, well, fundamentally, these sorts of things are pretty neat. I know. Mm-hmm. It's very cool. One of my hobbies is I make my own jewelry, and it's always been a very fascinating. Yeah, I am a silversmith.
Nice.
And you feel a real pull to particular pieces and things that you find, and I think that that's something that reaches back to, you know, to when humans started wearing jewelry, about like, you know, the things that you carry on your person are so special. Mm-hmm. And when you find something like an object like that, like a Thor's hammer, like some sort of, or a miniature sword or a spear or any sort of, you know, jewelry object that somebody kept close to their person, there's a magic about it. There's a real presence there. And there's often in intention and sort of this something that it says about the person that wore it, kind of like what we wear today. I love talking to people about why they wear the jewelry that they wear. Mm-hmm. What that means to them, and what, how it makes them feel, what it represents to the outside, what the viewer, or especially if people are wearing something close to their chest that's not visible to. There's something that to be said that object makes you feel something. Mm-hmm. Or there's a connection there. And I think that's something fairly universal. And that's one of the reasons why these sorts of objects are so fascinating.
Absolutely. So can we hazard a guess as to why these were so popular? Because they clearly were, like,
sure.
To put it back to the title of the podcast, it's a symbol of power. Obviously, it doesn't really have any practical use.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So there has to be some reason why we find so many of these, and why people were wearing them, why they were being made as well, because it takes time.
So why miniaturize an object at all, right? Why miniaturize a sword, right? You can't use the tiny miniature sword. Or why miniaturize a hammer and wear that? With swords in particular, these tiny miniature swords that you find, oftentimes they're unsheathed, right? There's not a scabbard on them, which to me kind of says something about martial readiness or something. It feels very active and almost protective in that respect. Oftentimes, I feel a little bit like that's what some of these are, is symbols that are active or protective in some way. With the Thor's hammer specifically, we get, of course, if we are trying to attach and taking the grapevines into account, for trying to attach meaning to that, I think it could be some sort of a bride gift, maybe, or some sort of protection of women. We get, of course, in some of the mythology, we get the hammer as, you know, symbol of, you know, Thor gets his hammer back after losing it by dressing up as a bride and getting the hammer gift placed on his lap while he's dressed as Freya at the Jotnar feast, right? That could be a suggestion or some sort of connection or echo from what these hammers might have been used for. You get really elaborate ones in Sweden with these beautiful heads and filigree and whatever else, that are perhaps very rich bridal gifts or something like that. You also get them in.
I like that idea.
It could be something like that.
I guess then, how would you explain the ones found in male graves?
I think you can also have the same protective element too, right? Thor was very martial with his hammer in the mythology. Yeah. He goes out and bashes Jotnar with it all the time, because and there's also, I think, a protective or martial element in that respect as well. My gut instinct is it's protective. That carrying something like that close to you gives you that sort of same protection that the hammer would represent in the mythology.
Yeah, because doesn't it say that the Thor's actual Mjolnir shrinks down into an amulet? Is that like a chicken and the egg situation with like, does the story come before the amulets, or does the amulet come from the?
Yeah, it's so hard with literature, right? Because it's hundreds of years after. So I think it could, who knows, maybe somebody like Snorri saw one of these things, or maybe some of the who knows there. But what I do know is the hammer was miniaturized, and we do get mentions of the hammer in mythology. And so there is some sort of something that happened in between, mm-hmm. where we've captured that, probably oral, right? Probably oral tradition that happened in between.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it does makes complete sense in being a protection type symbol, especially seen as Thor is seen as protecting Asgard, I guess, from those pesky giants.
Yeah.
And you can, so it would make, yeah, makes complete sense to have it as a protection symbol that you can kind of trust. But I do like the idea of it being a bridal gift. I've not heard that before, and it makes sense.
Well, you think about it, the whole the whole Thor's wedding sort of thing is a funny story just in general. But you know, we take these sorts of funny stories, and we can see echoes of these things in them. So,
mm-hmm. So what did you find when you spoke to modern day people about why they would wear the Mjolnir? I wonder if they're, what we can learn from that, and if, because this is one thing that we've come across many times on the podcast, that we forget that they're just people. These are just people. They're humans.
Oh, yeah.
And they lived in a very different time, but they still had very human emotions. So I'm sure there would be some correlation between why people wear it today and why people wore it then. And I wonder what we could learn, or at least theorize, from talking to people and asking.
Sure. There's a lot of reasons, of course, why people today wear jewelry, right? And especially symbols of, and typically it has to do with how it makes you feel and how it makes you seen. It of course, like wearing something, you know, presenting a certain way, it signals a belonging to a community. Sometimes mm-hmm. it signals your own personal values. It signals your aesthetic. It signals that sort of thing. I have every reason to believe same thing was true in the Viking Age, right? You're the things you wear signaled your social status, what your belonging was, what you were devoted to, the relationships you have with other people. And one of the things that I'm always fascinated by is, especially with some of these objects, that you find them in places that you wouldn't necessarily expect. So not necessarily just pendants, but you find them in places that might be a pocket.
Mm-hmm.
You find some of these pendants, if you find them in context at all. I found one of the head pendants was tucked under a jawbone, so maybe placed in the mouth when the deposition mm-hmm. happened. So there's also context about where these things are placed. And I'm sure people now, of course, carry symbols as on, you know, on their skin, on their neck, bracelets, etc. It's and various things like that, you know, give meaning to. And some people don't even ascribe meaning to objects, right? That's also a thing. It's sometimes they just look cool. But I tend to find when talking to people about why they're wearing certain symbols that are associated with the reception of the Viking Age, that it's often either an identity thing or it's something that makes them feel a certain way, or feel powerful or protected or whatever else, or a sense of belonging. And that tends to be what it is. Yeah.
I'm curious to hear, did you speak to many Americans about wearing the mill neck, particularly because is it listed as a hate symbol now?
There is, I think in Southern Poverty Law Center website, there are certain shapes and things.
You do hear stories of some people in, it seems to be certain, the ones I hear always tend to be like stateside, of people getting grief from wearing a Thor's hammer. So I wondered if you spoke to those people and the idea of why they would kind of maybe not risk wearing it, but still, because you know nobody wants to be called a racist. It's just a bad day, isn't it? Nobody wants that thrust upon them just for wearing something that's clearly not linked to that, but is unfortunately being co-opted by assholes.
Oh yeah. Okay. So one of the things that I study in my research, just in general, is, and why I my thesis is called The Rise and Fall of These Sorts of Symbols, is that these symbols, the context and meaning of them change over time. What they were in the Viking Age is very different than what they were preserved in the literature. It's what they're very different than what they've changed into now. And it's not just one continuum, it's several continuums, right? And if you're going to get people who are co-opting and changing the meaning of these things over time. And that's what's happened in certain contexts in certain places. And of course, like, as people who are introspective and aware of history and whatever else, it's important to look around and to understand the way these things have evolved, and to be aware of that. And it's a shame that, you know, that these symbols have been co-opted and it's really in lots of ways. But I also think there's a lot of really great people who are fighting against a lot of these misconceptions, mm-hmm. that have been taken out of context and whatever else. And that's a turn that is really positive. And of course you're going to get a whole bunch, a bunch of, especially in the States, in that context, some of these fringe wackos that are taking some of the very, and we've talked about how ambiguous and how varied the tradition, the old Nordic religion was. And they're like, no, there was one thing and only one group of people, did this, and that's the right way. There's no right way. What is that? What is right way? Yeah, there wasn't even a right way in the Viking Age. So why is there a right way today?
Exactly. And I think so that's why we kind of created the podcast, so we could put that information out and then people could use it in situations, I guess, where they're maybe confronted and told that something is racist, that there's not, but could come back with maybe a historical answer, or at least a somewhat kind of understood one. Because, and this is the point that I was going to make, that for the most part, the people, because we're so kind of involved in this world and involved in the Viking Age and Nordic mythology and this whole community, I think a lot of people forget that most people aren't, and like most average people aren't. They don't give a fuck about Vikings. Like, just most people in the world, they just got better shit. They can't, they like other stuff, and that's fine. Everyone can't like the same thing. They might be wrong, but not everyone can like the same thing. So they don't know any better. So when they see some dickhead going into, onto Capitol Hill wearing a symbol, sure, they go, oh, that symbol is just inherently racist, because they don't know any better. And it's not their fault either, because it's just not their field of interest. They just don't know. They just kind of go, oh, well, here's a symbol. Here's a guy who stands for a certain thing. He's wearing a certain outfit adorned with certain tattoos and symbols. And they go, oh, they must just be racist. And then when you get authorities who put out kind of things that say, well, these symbols are now linked as hate symbols, then they just furthermore kind of proves that Discord to the average person. They go, oh, well, this must just be a symbol of hate. So then that kind of just ties it into the average person just assumes this. So therefore you need people who can then kind of educate or try to explain why they're not, and be able to be like, no, these are just historical symbols, unfortunately,
sure,
taken out of context by some people
and nationalists and whatever else. Yeah, it's always something that when you're talking about a symbol like this, and that is has preserved, it has persevered throughout the ages and has a modern reception, right? It has a modern context as well as the historic one. It's really important to untangle that, and also, and it's worthy of study in its own right as well as what the modern reception of that symbol is. Mm-hmm. But it has absolutely nothing to do with what it meant in the Viking Age.
Yeah,
and that is something really important to hammer home to people. Not nice, excuse
point.
The pun.
Nice point. Yeah.
But
I saw it.
Yeah, there you go. But that it's something that you always need to mention when talking about these things and an introduction or whatever. But you also have to be like, this, we're not talking about now. We're talking about what it meant to the people who made them. And it's perfectly good to address that sort of thing now. But what it was then wasn't what it is now.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you have to be careful to not let things go too far, because sometimes things go too far and you just can't take them back. Like, like the swastika. That has...
Oh, yeah. It's got its own...
Yeah, it has so much history prior to World War II and the Nazi Party. Like, it has, there's so much history in it, and it has its own meanings. And probably still does in some places of the world. But equally, like, that symbol is just so connected to such a dark time that it can't, in my personal opinion, it just can't be removed from it now. It just is this thing. It's kind of lost. You can't, there's been numerous campaigns over the years of like, take back the swastika, and I'm sure they start in very kind of innocent ways, and they probably have a very kind heart behind them of just wanting to make this symbol back to its original meaning. But you just can't, something like that, you just can't, particularly when you have so many people that are still left from the wounds of it happening. And that would be my fear with symbols like Milner, the Valknut. When you get these symbols that start getting more and more co-opted and used in these things, that they start to get to that point where it's the point of no return, where they're that kind of assimilated with these groups that you just can't kind of claw them back.
Sure. Yeah. It's important to be cognizant of it. It's also important to educate people about what these things actually mean and what they were doing, what that it's not always just the context of now, there was context before. But that's where, but as you say, that's not where most people come into contact with this type of stuff, right? Yeah, most people come into contact, the first time people see a giant Thor's hammer tattoos on some guy who's storming the Capitol building, right? Like that's not necessarily good good PR for Thor's hammer, you know.
No.
And of course, like it's I know academic Twitter went absolutely wild that day with Viking, you know, and Viking Age scholars and literature scholars and things. And those sorts of conversations are really important. I'm not a modern day reception scholar, but there are so many wonderful scholars who are doing really great, important work about these sorts of issues. And it's really important to have it be talked about and studied in a scholarly way. And also for people to really break it down. So I'm glad that those conversations are happening.
Yeah, I think that as long as the conversations happen kind of freely, because equally you get with anything, you get, it's all a spectrum, isn't it? You get the two polarizing ends that usually end up kind of bending around into like a circle and almost being like each other in the end. But and then you get kind of all the points in between. So you have like some uses of it will be seen as more radical than others. And then scholars will disagree on sometimes this caught up in infighting that you kind of forget the overall kind of goal and you get this like bickering between rather than having these free and open conversations where you kind of can just say and just theorize and toss out ideas and kind of just have those chats rather than get caught up on the little bickers, I guess, sometimes.
Sure. Yeah. It's easy to get caught up in that sort of the little points, isn't it? Especially in academic contexts where so much of talking about, you know, symbols, where we do so much close reading of the objects, where we're not even looking at context beyond what the object actually, what's physically on the object and that sort of thing, that sometimes you lose sight of a bigger picture as well. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's really good to chat with other people about it. There's an example of that is very recently I've been looking at some of these miniature thrones that we find, these sorts of seats that some scholars say are Hliðskjalf, you know, Odin's throne. Some scholars say they're chairs for Seder. Some, you know, some think they're just thrones, just in general, maybe kingship or something like that. There's a very famous figure, this Odin, and I put Odin in air quotes because it's debated whether or not it's Odin or not, from Lyra, right? There, and it's this little person sitting on a throne, and there's two like sort of bird-like figures, and immediately people go, oh, of course, that's Odin in that chair. Those are Odin's ravens. And you start close reading the object, or you start looking at it really closely, and you notice the object, the figure in the chair might be wearing, you know, a dress, maybe some sort of female clothing. So maybe is it Freya? Is it not a goddess or god at all? Is it just a person in the chair? Is it a king? Is it a ruler? Various questions. What very recently, I was close reading this object. I was talking to a friend, you know, here in Oxford, you kind of mix with all different types of scholars and all sorts of different things. I was talking to an ornithologist at lunch one day. So it's a bird person, right? And, you know, what are you researching? I'm like, oh, I research this stuff. What interesting thing have you been looking at? Well, here's a picture of this thing I've been looking at. Maybe these are ravens. And I talked about the same thing I just told you guys about. The ornithologist goes, ravens don't cross their wings. I was like, what?
Oh, really?
The birds have their wings crossed. And she goes, ravens don't cross their wings. I'm like, what? She's like, well, they don't. Lo and behold, they, I, you know, ravens will cross their wings. And I'm like, huh, well, that, I don't think it rules out them being ravens, but they could just be birds. And so you get lost in those sorts of points sometimes, right? Where you're not necessarily, you know, sometimes you get really granular. And man, it's so interesting, but it's so not satisfying sometimes to just be like, oh, I'm not sure.
Yeah, well, but that's, I think we all have to learn to be a little more comfortable in the unknown. We all just want everything to be black and white in little boxes, but things are just unknown sometimes. And we,
it's so tempting.
Yeah, we have to. And I can't remember who I was speaking to that made this point about these little figures and how they're always, people always want to test them to a god or goddess. They always have to be somebody. They can't just be a little figure. Sorry, Rocco decided to pick the squeakiest toy in the world to play with right now. Yeah, people always want to test them to being a little person. It can't just be a figure. And I guess I can understand why you'd want it to be a god, or why you would think that it would be, because I guess it's important enough that it's been made, so it probably would be a god maybe. But just, yeah, it's kind of, sometimes you can just be happy being saying, like, maybe it's Odin, not it is. Whereas I think a lot of people just want that kind of, it is. Just tell me it is. Just tell me who it is. I just want to know 100%.
My partner is a computer scientist. And whenever he reads my work, he's always like, it's always probably this or likely or could be. It's like, I can't make a claim with these sorts of things unless I have build a time machine, go back and talk. And even then, unless you talk to everybody, it could be different things to different people. There's really no definite answer.
And you really go on.
No, absolutely. We're just working with this Swiss cheese.
But you have to really cover your own back, because otherwise one of your peers is going to come along and go, well, you fucking didn't put a probably in here, and you should have put a probably in here. So,
because you do get that.
But equally, that's good as well, because it keeps everybody honest.
Look, it challenges things too. It really does. It's very good. And I've seen a lot of really great scholars get into wonderful debates about the nature of the thing that comes to mind is a panel at a saga conference I sat in on, where they were talking about if the Vanir were actually a thing or not, and they just this wonderful discourse that happened back and forth, and then the two scholars went and got a beer after, you know, because this is what people do, right? School, you know, you just have opinions, and you talk about it, but then, you know, it's okay to have, nobody knows what's really right. Right. Mm-hmm. We're all just making really good points. I've sat down with books sometimes or articles, read one article that had an amazingly convincing article, read the exact opposite point of view, and gone, oh, that's really convincing too. What do I actually think here?
Yeah.
They both make good points.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Well, this is a perfect point. You know, it all depends on how things are read, how we look at things, our perception we have on it, our own kind of, got on the word,
like biases almost.
Yeah, sometimes. Biases. Yeah, kind of like our own prejudices that we have just in life, just from life experiences, so that it makes us look at things a certain way and apply our own kind of opinions to it that aren't always right. And it's hard to remove all that and look at something completely objectively.
Yeah. No, it really is. And you have to recognize your own voice in some things too, and take your own experience out of it there. But it's really hard. And also that's just how that is. And you have to do that with scholarship too, where you go back and you look at scholarship for various time periods. You know, a guy from the 19th century is going to have his own biases that you're reading scholarship wise. So you have to be careful with that. We have our modern day biases when it comes to academia, and we have to kind of unpick that. So, you know, you get somebody like Snorri too as his own biases, and you have to unpick that. The written sources are fraught with context and biases, and there's no, and you have to interrogate every little thing, which is one of the reasons why it's really good, if you're really into this, to learn Old Norse and go back to the source text, because a lot of times the translations are biased to you. And you need to form your own opinions about that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, perfect. Okay, we've done an hour and 20. Let's wrap this up, and I'm sure there's more we could talk about, and you're always welcome back, and we can explore more symbols of power. But I have a show that I'm trading at the weekend in London, and I have a bunch of stuff I still have to get ready for it. So,
So you're coming to, are you in the UK now?
I live in the UK. Yeah. I mean,
I didn't know that.
Yeah. I'm in Yorkshire. I'm in Huddersfield.
Okay. Oh, so neat. Okay.
Closest to Leeds.
Very cool.
But yeah, so we're going to sit down. Did Bob ask you to do a little Q&A after?
I don't know. I'm free if you want.
Yeah, sure. If you have like 15, 20 minutes. Yeah. Usually we let the patrons ask some questions that maybe I've missed. We'll just do a little Q&A. So if people listen, if you do want to, with every guest we have, we always do, sometimes it's 15, 20 minutes. Sometimes it's like a whole other show where we just sit and the patrons can ask some questions. You can submit your questions before the podcast or watch the show live. And that's just that's just when people support any level on Patreon, which is just £3 a month, and it's just Patreon.com/ Nordic Mythology Podcast, and there's a bunch of other bonus stuff you get over there.
Sounds good. Yeah, I have a calendar block until 9, so you've got me for a little while longer.
Oh, wonderful. Perfect. Yeah, so sorry, someone just made a comment in the chat about my arms, because I'm playing tug with Rocco, but I think it looks a little bit suspect, so it's just the angle of things. He's just playing with his toy. If we can, yeah, we'll just do a little Q&A. And if people, do you want to let people know where they can find you? If I don't know if you have a public persona or profile that you would like anyone to follow.
I have an Instagram, but it's a private one. But I do have a Instagram that also is public, that I post pictures of, pretty pictures of Oxford. So my private one is Katie Lorenz Beard, and my public one is Another Oxford Defil. Other than that, I don't use Twitter very often. I do have a Twitter handle, but I'm not active at all. Other than that, I'm not particularly, interesting on the internet.
Oh, fair enough.
Except for the database, which is at etrydb.com.
Yeah, we'll make sure we tag that in the show notes. Again, if you like the podcast, please leave us a 5-star rating, a positive review wherever you get your podcasts. And you can follow me, Daniel_Farrand1, on Instagram, or the business Horns of Odin. And obviously Nordic Mythology Podcast on everything, whether it's Facebook, YouTube, Instagram. So yeah, let's jump over and answer some questions.